You've already talked about Russell Brand, so we can't talk about that because
Yeah,
you've
that's
talked about that in detail. I was
yes.
hoping we could talk about that, but that you talk about that on your you talk about dirty shit on your other podcast.
Yeah,
This is
no,
the clean version of Tom.
yeah,
This
it's
is
the
the
high
Tom
and
and
the low.
Andrew
No,
show. We're
it's the high and the low. The lowest form of entertainment is culture wang, and we have the most sublime, sacred stuff that we're talking
No, but we don't get as we go don't get as down and dirty as you and Masha, I guess. Which just
about.
makes me feel actually, a little bit jealous.
Right. No, but that actually, we had yesterday an extravaganza, which comes out probably, the next days. And one of the aspects that came up yesterday was envy. And so that's one of the themes that kind of resonated in my mind.
Me too. You know what, Tom? I was going to suggest that as a subject for this podcast, and then I forgot, and you brought it up. So we're synced,
It's
man.
it is not only that we are synced, like it's supposed to happen,
It's got to happen. It had to
it's
happen.
gonna,
It's in the
yes.
stars.
So
Envy, envy. Yes, because
yes.
there was an actually a very good clip by Nassim Taleb, who you sometimes talk about envy, and
Oh yeah, I've seen that.
he
Yes.
says, pay attention to what you envy. I envy people who are like know Latin and are very erudite. If you're a stock market guy, you envy people who have more money than you. And we always think of envy as a very negative thing. Like it's our we're most ashamed of our own envy, I think, because we
Yeah.
want to think that we're, equal to everybody. But everybody envy everybody envies everybody all the time. I was thinking like, my neighbor has a bigger house than me, and I envy him for that, and he envies me because I have more time and have a more interesting job, and then I envy you because you have so many you have so many girlfriends, and you envy me because I'm married and have kids, and
Right.
we envy each other. I envy people who are richer than me and more successful, and people who are less successful envy me because so it's we're always in the envying each other all the time. It's just what we do as human beings. So it
Yep.
is an important thing that we have to sort of think about. And I think all dramas and all the story, Proust, his big epic book is almost like the core of it is almost about envy, and
Yeah.
it goes into detail about he envies somebody who's already dead, his girl boyfriend or girlfriend. I mean, it was a girl, but it was actually a man because Bruce was gay, but he was envying her a relationship that she was already dead. So he describes his and him this character going and finding out all the things that this person who had an affair did with this person, just the minutia of envy discussed in intense detail. It's a very interesting subject.
Yeah. It's like there's this Christian substructure that tells you that envy is not good. Is it even
Yeah.
like a one of the cardinal sins, envy, or is it jealousy, or what is that?
Coveting your neighbor's wife.
Yeah, but in a weird way, if you disconnect it from, the Christian context, envy tells you where you are in
Yeah,
life.
yeah,
And
yeah.
it's such an
And where
interesting
you're
point.
going and what you want
Yes,
and
exactly.
all these
And
things.
so I wouldn't confuse it, with, rage like jealousy, which is like, some form of supercharged envy, I would say, maybe. But
Envy's a little more subtle than jealousy, perhaps. Is that what you mean?
yeah, I mean, when you're like in the situation where, I told you this, I was once in a polyamorous situation with, total four persons and four people. But, you get into contact with these primal emotions, because it's not still, I think it's one of the harder things to swallow, your girlfriend coming home, and because you know her for 10 years, you know exactly that you just fucked the other guy. And so
yeah,
it's like there's you can
you have an intense attachment to somebody and you want them to be yours. This is my girlfriend, you know.
Yes.
And almost everybody has that. It's my wife, my girlfriend, you know. And so so that's why polyamory must be I've never done it, but a challenging business.
Yeah,
unless you've really worked on it and you're able to go beyond your envy and you feel so confident in yourself that you don't have to worry about somebody else, which is pretty impossible, I would say.
Well, yeah, you that's what I mean. You confront baseline emotions, the most basic emotions and feelings that you can have.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you work through it with a form of therapy or meditation or whatever technique you use, when you're confronted, let's say, with the real of the situation, right? It's like, that's painful. And that's, the moment of, when it's going introverted, and you're tearing up yourself because, you want to overcome these kinds of issues and these kinds of automatic feelings. And then it goes extroverted and you take a chair and you smash it against the wall in this rage. It's like, that's
who we envy. Are.
Huh?
That's who we are.
Exactly.
In a primal level.
Right. And so, but that's, I'm not talking about that when I'm talking about envy. It's like that's some supercharged jealousy and, all these kinds of things. Envy, I think, like if you calibrate your system well and you have a high self-awareness, you can use envy.
Yeah. Right. And also the interesting thing about envy is that we're always pretending we don't have it. We're always pretending that we don't care what people think. I don't care what people think is like a mantra. I don't give a shit what anybody thinks. It's always untrue in a way. It's always a lie because everybody cares what everybody thinks all the time. And we're always measuring ourselves up to somebody who's, if you're old, you're envious of the young. And if you're young, you're envious of the old. And, there's always right. somebody who's bigger or better or smarter or cooler than you are. And we're always pretending, oh, I don't care what they think of me that's just an ego. That's just the ego facade below all of this teeming envy that everybody has.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of these concepts from Lacan where I think it's at the same time very sublime and at the same time very stupid, the concept of the other. It's like this concept has been described for eternity by other people. He put it in the words of the other and said, and so his idea is that we're talking with the other and we're like in constant dialogue about where we are. And,
yeah.
But it's like.
Yeah. Well, it's funny how like sometimes we're in sync with the other and sometimes we're not. Like sometimes we do a podcast and you put it out and you're like, and you give it a title and it's like, was that what we were talking about? I had a whole different perception of the podcast. I thought we were talking about something else.
Right.
because I had my, associations of what I think, the thing was, and you had yours. And since you're putting it out, it might be a totally different podcast in my mind than what you experienced.
Oh no, I'm completely on autopilot. I'm just recording it, and then the first idea that comes to mind, that is a little bit, at least has a quip in it or at least a bit funny or whatever, I use it.
Yeah, and sometimes I'm on the same page. I'm like, yeah, that was the thing that stuck out for me. Sometimes it's something else, right? Sometimes I'm totally like, what is that the same podcast? but yeah, we're probably, me and you are probably envious of each other on some level and in competition, and we would do everything in there to deny that that's what's happening because we don't want to admit that we have that. It's so uncomfortable. Like envy is so terribly uncomfortable and shameful and we don't want to feel that.
I don't know. I'm not entirely convinced because I mean, you even mentioned that, you have stuff that I long for. It goes both ways.
Yeah, it goes both ways. Of course, it goes both ways.
So it's like we're talking openly about those things. Mm-hmm. For me, to strive for some, you know, stability of family. That's, you know, that's what I'm kind of envious for.
Yeah, and you have all these adventures, and tell me about all the wild women that you're with, and I'm like, oh, those days are over for me, you know.
It seems even that envy is not a personal feeling, but like a structural one, and that might be the interesting thing, because you never can have everything. And as soon as you decide for, you know, a path of life, then you decide against all other possible things. And by that mechanism, envy emerges as a side product.
Yeah.
That's like that, you know, because you can't get rid of it.
You can't get rid of it. I think we should probably try to not be envious. Like, we should try to reduce our envy, you know. But again, it's a primordial human emotion, or at least be attentive to it. Or it's like, okay, I'm feeling this, and like, okay, don't act on that feeling, because, or behave in a way that would, you know, promote that feeling or exaggerate that feeling. It's like, because you can nurse something, you can nurse your envy and become like Gollum, you know, with his ring, and you're like my precious, and again, this is what I learned from Girard. We were talking about Girard last night. He always talks about mimetic desire, and the whole principle of capitalism is based on envy. You know, you want what other people want, and, you know, people have things that you don't have, and that's always being pushed in your face to make you envious, so that you become desirous and you desire this thing and that everybody has. And it's just a constant assault of trying to promote envy within you. So again, it's something you can avoid. But the interesting thing that he says is like, okay, you think you want something because you want it, right?
Yeah.
But you want something much more when somebody else wants it. Like, if we're in competition for the same woman, that woman becomes hyper attractive, much more attractive than if we just met her. And also, the fact that she's attractive is part biological, but part because other people are attracted to her. So we want something because other people want it. We think that our desire is pure, but it's never pure. It's always mediated by what other people want. That's the Girardian kind of point about desire. So
the interesting thing is Jonathan Haidt, you know, the psychologist. So he posted an article on Twitter on, you know, the consequences of AI girlfriends on young women, because it's not only that you can have like a girlfriend avatar nowadays. You know, you choose, you know, what she looks like and color of her eyes and body types, and when you see the photographs or the videos that the AI is able to generate, that looks, you can't, you know, distinguish that anymore from real girls. But then additionally to that, you have proper AI girlfriends now, so you can choose character traits, right? And so they can be tough, or they can be loving, and they always love your shit, you know. And the problem is that
the girls start to compare themselves to the AI,
because young women can't compete with that, you know. And that puts extra pressure onto them. I mean, already with the social media, there's so much pressure on them to look like Kim Kardashian or whatever. But, you know, that it's not just only looks, but also like behaviors now that you can be envious of. You know, that's...
Yeah, that's why it's such a primordial, basic, you know, thing that you can manipulate. You can manipulate it because... You can manipulate envy because we're always hiding it. And so you go directly to the subconscious mind, right?
Right.
You know, it's not like in advertising, what people there, if you look at how advertising evolved over time, they used to have this, you should buy this car because this reason, you know, a paragraph, and then the car describing why you should buy the car in details. Now they'll just show you a little kind of like piece of the car that's the color red and that's shaped like a woman's body, you know,
right.
And no words at all, just bypassing the verbal structure of the brain and going right to the subconscious.
Yeah.
That's the trick of advertising, going right to your envy. It's like, oh, your lack, you know, I don't have this, you know, and it's so desirable. And then you start to, you know, drool and, you know, want something, you know.
Yeah, but this is the human story. It's not just, you know, it's like probably supercharged by marketing and capitalism and all of this. But I mean, that's such a primordial mechanism, you know, that we want something.
Well, where does desire, it come from? Desire. He is the, in Buddhism, they say desire is the human realm. We're made of desire. It's like, that's what we are.
Yeah.
The human realm is just desire. It's like, that's what we do, that's what we are, that's what all our problems and all our highs and lows are all about. We desire something. Do we have it or do we not have it? You know, we always desire something, but we never, you know, get it, you know. We
have you ever seen Club Random with Bill Maher?
No.
So he just published like an interview with Julian Lennon, right, the son of John. Yep. And Julian is, you know, he's 60 now, and I don't know how old Bill Maher is. But because it's such a laid-back atmosphere of, you know, of the interview setting, and so they go through the typical Beatles stuff and John and George and Paul and Ringo and all that stuff that happened. But then very fast they come into the deep stuff. You know, and so Julian openly admits, you know, all to these desires that he still has, you know, with 60. And you would think, oh shit, man, it really never ends. You know, you can be.
You mean desire, sex desires or desires?
Yeah, no, it's like in his case. So he says he had lots of relationships, but he still longs for, you know, a specific type of relationships. And so it's like.
Mm-hmm.
But he comes from this family with all this money and
he has everything. You mean he's still full of desire, is it, you know?
Yeah exactly. Like,
there's no limit to what you could desire, you know. Who is that guy who, like, he scammed people for billions of dollars, you know? What was his name? And like
Jordan Belfort, or like, what do you mean?
No, I guess there's a few of them. I was thinking of this one that he's like, he made billions of dollars as a kind of a hedge fund manager, eventually got caught like in New York. But, you know, why would he want like so many billions? Is $1 billion not enough? Like, it just, there's always this intense desire for more and more and more and more and more. And anyway, yeah, it's a bit of a cliche.
You think that is the same mechanism?
There's a perversion there. There's a strange perversion about the human mechanism? Nature. As what?
Well, I mean, it's like, okay, so imagine you can't pay your bills, you can't pay
Bernie your Madoff, whatever his name was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great hedge fund manager. Everybody thought he was God. You know, he was like worshipped.
Yeah.
Right? And then, but he was, you know, scamming millions of people in this incredibly elaborate pyramid scheme. Why would he do that? Why would you do that? Imagine the intensity of, like.
Yeah, maybe there has to be like a landscape of envy, you know, the different types of envy and desire, you know, because, you know, to be accepted by others, you know, the envy, you know, I mean, like some people also have just drive to do stuff, you know, they are like doers, they're like highly conscientious, highly extroverted, and, you know, it's not, I don't, I'm not entirely.
You mean they're not necessarily driven by envy?
By lack.
They're driven by a positive.
I mean, you can have the spiritual, you know, approach and say, you know, it's like, you know, existence is always kind of lack. And so you try to go back to the non-dual.
Is emptiness. So lack is the same thing in the way as like, as filling some void. Well, people, why do people work so hard? You know, is it just for the joy of doing it? And, or, you know, I guess it's a question of motivation, right? And you're always, you need to work on your motivations. Like, why the fuck am I doing, why am I doing this? And how do I get into the right state of motivation where it's not a motivation? It's not a pseudo motivation or a inherited motivation or a, you know, wrongly directed motivation or neurotic motivation. You know, there is good motivation, you know, I think, I hope, I mean,
you know, I
not I was, pure, but
I was thinking about this the other day because so I have lots of things that are uneven in my life, you know, in terms of, and we're still talking about envy, you know, like for example, like a family or something. But there's like one area in my life where I think that's just right. Even if I mean, I could scale it up and say I could do more of this.
Yeah.
But I mean, like I'm publishing exactly the books that I want to publish. I have exactly with the podcasting, the, you know, the different kinds of conversations that I want to have, you know, and what we do with Parallax, exactly what I want. And it's like this, it's literally, you know, a way for me to approach the edge of what I can do, what I'm able to do, and where I can grow.
That's right? The place to be, right?
Yeah. And I can scale it up and say, sure, it would be nice to have more of that, more money, more people, more like more podcasts.
That's
like,
why envy is a trap in a way sometimes, right? It's like, yeah, it's like you're, if you're on the threshold of creativity, you're doing better, and you might have envy for somebody who does a little different than you, or, you know, has a better, slicker presentation or whatever, but if you start to like fixate on that, then you're lost, right?
Right.
Like you have to remain within the threshold of maximal, you know, positive kind of productive development, I would say.
Yeah, but what I want to say, it's like there in this area, also with the books I'm writing, I'm not, it's not consciously reacting, you know, toward, you know, from envy. It's just, you know, where I feel there is an edge where I can grow, you know, where I enter the unknown, where I enter the chaos and try to do, you know, to grow, basically. It's not reactive in form of, oh, I feel envy, I have to fill that void. It's on the other side of the
rainbow. Got it. Well, you know? I mean, it might be that you're aspiring to something, right? But it doesn't, it's not, it's based on wanting to be better. It's not a negative thing. Like envy tends to be considered negative. Like it's probably positive, right? that Nassim Taleb wants to, you know, he's envious of people who are great scholars because that improves his scholarship, right? You know, but that's a positive kind of wanting to emulate something. That's, you know, I think it's good to have people who are, I mean, everybody, it's good to look up to people and have models in a way, because if we didn't have that, we would just stay how we are. So
I think it was Taleb that, you know, had this example, you know, this example with the rat and the different motivations. And so you have a rat and you put like a spring back on their tail so you can measure the force by which the rat is moving forward, right? And so you put something in front of the rat, you know, like a piece of sugar or whatever, and so the rat will create some force to move forward, and you can measure that, how much that is. And then you, what you can do the same is to create an effect where the rat has kind of fear, right, and tries to avoid something, and that will also create a forward movement, which you can measure. And he says, you know, the way you can maximize on positive and negative motivation is then when you have both, when you have something, when you want to strive towards something, but at the same time you want to leave something behind.
Well, in the course of the Nita, we were talking about like all these things that are often considered negative, right? Like gossip. This is a good one because she told me that, you know, so in the management circles, people were trying to say, okay, we got to make this company less toxic and get rid of gossip.
Right.
And when they did that, the company fell apart. because gossip is an integral part of company culture, which keeps the company together. So actually, even though gossip is, you know, considered negative, you know, it, traditionally, and also even Illich says this in his book, you know, the women who went out to washing clothes and the, you know, at the well, they would gossip about the men. This is like in very traditional, you know, sexist society. And that would keep the men honest and you know, strong, and because they were afraid of what the women think. And so there's a way in which there's a power to gossip. Like, women's gossip is extremely powerful. And we just think of it as a kind of a negative thing that shouldn't happen. Right. But often what's considered negative is actually part of the it's an integral part of the totality of what works, or, you know.
Yeah, you have that on different scales. You have that, you know, cognitively, emotionally, with envy that belongs to the system to make the system work, to know where you, then you have it on a social level with things like gossip, but then you also have like it on a financial level, or like on a global societal level, that you need, you know, whores and beggars. And we talked about this
before. And you need an efficiency in a company for it to work properly. Like, the whenever you try to control the company, make it super efficient, it doesn't work. So you have to build inefficiencies into a good system.
Right.
You have to build redundancies and inefficiencies and negativities into a system. Otherwise, you're heading for some platonic model which never works and just becomes the opposite of that. It becomes it becomes hyper rigid and the whole system breaks down.
Right.
Yeah.
It's Christianity. Now the ideal of the Protestant life. But you can't have, again, you can't have a clean artist, like a politically clean artist. You can't have, you know, the absolute absolute marriage without ever going astray or flirting with other people. You can't have, you know, a capitalistic system without people that kind of, try to step out of that system. And you have, you know.
Yeah, you need this, you need a whole landscape of complexity that often what appears to be something that you want to get rid of is actually compost for the larger, you know, production of the of the whole ecosystem, something like
that. It's weird how that works, you know, and it's like that we're still not able to have this conversation culturally. You know, that we need the messy stuff. And you know, it's like nothing is clear cut. And you know, it's like you get what, even like in conversations about gender or whatever, it's every topic you make or every topic that you observe in culture, they the intention is always to create like a clear cut image.
Yeah. And but who wants a clear cut image? You know, it's like, I guess people do want a clear-cut image, and that's just because it makes them feel safe, and most people want to be safe and secure and live in a coherent reality. They understand. On the other hand, that isn't life at all. You know, that's not the world.
No, it's super interesting because, you know, polyamory. I wasn't that, you know, long relationship, and. The effect was that we increasingly with the years talked about the stuff that was outside of the membrane of that thing. And you can't live for that long without acknowledging what's in between, let's say. And then we try to open up the membrane to embrace all the other stuff.
Yeah, you know, and maybe it opened up too much, and that destroyed the thing. You know, whatever it could be, you just have to have the right balance. If it's too closed, then it's dead, and if it's too open, maybe.
But I can't. Yes, but the point is that I still can't decide, because like even if that time was shorter, and only like let's say 20%, we did this for 3 years, for like in a 13-year. Overall relationship, and it was like, so it was like a short amount of time, like a third, let's say, But it is what way more intense. And I will remember that the details of that phase for all my life, and the other stuff, sure, but it was more love. Yeah. You know, it was a higher intensity. I was, you know, I was challenged way more, you know, because like one woman is insane, two of those are extra insane. And I, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, my first wife was insane, and and I had all kinds of adventures that were interesting in retrospect. I wouldn't fucking want to live through that again, that's for sure. But you know, there was lots of, I think that was a high threshold learning period for me, even though it was like sublime torture or something. I don't know. Yeah, it's just a high threshold period. But also, I think that was a good experience for me, because then I sort of knew what I wanted the next time. And before I didn't really know, I didn't know what I wanted. So I had to fail in like every possible way, in a dramatic and ridiculous. And, you know, I just had to like hit bottom. And then now I have a pretty good marriage, because I think I lived through that catastrophe.
Right.
So the catastrophe was part of the whole story and system of, so, you know, we have to live through the catastrophe sometimes.
Yeah, but I would be cautious.
Maybe it wasn't a catastrophe for you, but
yeah,
but
I would be cautious to use a word like that, because I, you know, because in that phase, at least on my side, there was so much stuff that propelled me forwards in different ways. It was highly attached to pain, but also to ecstasy in a kind of way,
mm-hmm.
you know, trance and all these kinds of things. And so I wouldn't, you know, I mean, I'd like, if you put on all the bad connotations from, you know, if you get rid of all the bad connotations from a word like catastrophe and use it in the sense of complexity theory, that, you know, there are like major shifts just going on, and these can be positive or negative, right?
Sure.
Then it makes kind of sense. But again, it was a highly, for me, a highly important experience, and I still kind of cling to them.
Yeah, you know? Well, it's the kairos. It's the period of change, right?
Right.
The kairos, is that's very intense. And I guess this is why people like the meaning crisis. They really want a meaning crisis in a way. Like,
that's,
they want to go through a meaning crisis because they want to feel like they're alive and things are significant and matter. You know?
Bravo. There you have it.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
That's what your critique of the meaning crisis is, I guess.
Yes, because it's like, that's because then you have a motivation, you know, to look at the world like this, and then it makes sense. Then the whole thing is complete. But if you just say there is a meaning crisis without acknowledging your true motivation, that you want to change and that you want to have a watershed moment, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think people, often externalize that. They say it's the world.
Right.
People do that all the time. I was at the Zen monastery with all these young guys, and they were all talking about the meaning crisis and the meta crisis, and you know, they were just obsessed with it, absolutely obsessed with it. And I think, okay, they're going through, you know, what 20-year-olds go through.
Yeah,
it's really about them, you know.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
How do I have a relationship with the world? But they're calling it an external meaning crisis, and they're getting all kind of depressed about it instead of having some, let's say having a bit of style, you know, and a bit of flamboyance in their pain, you know. I think we have to have character. It's like we have to be sort of positive no matter what's happening in some ways.
I mean,
so I think there's a depressive quality to the doomers. You know, maybe the world is gonna fall apart, but we're gonna fall apart. That's the thing. Like, we're all gonna die. Yes, the world's gonna fall apart. Maybe that's just what has to happen and what's gonna happen. And, you know, it's like trying to prevent reality from happening. I'm not saying in any way that we shouldn't try to prevent things, bad things, from happening, but you know what I mean. It's like a denial of it's running from death, as Woody Allen would say. He's like looking at all these joggers, they're running from death.
Yeah, I mean, There are two things. The first thing, and we talked about this, is the reality tunnel, as Wilson would put it. You know, to view the world through the tunnel, the reality tunnel, as crisis. That's one thing. And on the other side, you have young people, and young people always are drama queens because they are in a phase of transition. And it's like when I was between 19 or 18 and 22, it's like, yeah, that was my feeling. And I was obviously I was reading.
I was like that until I was 40, Tom. So you did better than me. I was I'm still a bit of a drama queen, I think. But anyway.
No, but I really, you know, and but it makes sense if you want that for yourself, if you want, you know, some form of transformation, you know, and which is perfectly fine, you know.
Yeah, that's a cool thing you say. Yeah, because I was thinking about how when you hang out with young guys, there's a way in which it's like they're so young and they have so much energy and they're so beautiful and they're so inspired and. Yeah, at the same time, the whole fucking thing is rotten. You know, it's like you can't relate to that because you've had experience. You know, you can't really relate to that. You end up being like the old guy at the party because you're like, yeah, I know what's going on here and I don't buy it anymore.
Yeah.
Like when you're young, you need to have some sort of idealism and that's perfectly fine. And when you're old, you don't buy the shit anymore of the stories that people tell.
Yeah,
sort kind of thing. So that's what I observe. So I really like hanging around with young people, but I also like realize I have to keep a distance from that because it's like I'm not that age anymore. And I think we have all of these different ages inside of us. Like in 1 minute we could become a child, you know, right? And in 1 minute we could become a teenager, and another minute we can become like. An older person. Like we're living all of these things simultaneously, all these different periods of our life are happening now in that way. It's not so linear. So sometimes you feel like a teenager, you know, when you feel rejected from the peer group, and sometimes you get just crazily emotional, like a child would for no reason at all. And all these things are going on in us. So we have to know where we're at in that whole story and recognize all the different parts of us. It's like a non-linear thing. It's like time is happening simultaneously. We're still working on things that we were working on when we were 17, but yet we're like, I'm 52. So, you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, additionally, it's like when you're in that age, if you're like 18, 19, and you're confronted with two things. You're confronted with unimaginable libidinal drive that preoccupies your mind, and on the other side, you know, all the negative programming from your parents and your surroundings that manifest as neurosis,
which you haven't learned to deal with yet.
Yeah, exactly. And so those two things come together, and you have to find a way to find a place in the world.
That's why older people are happier, like apparently. It's true statistically, even though you know we're like. We're falling apart and, you know, it's not going to go on that longer, much longer. And, you know, everything is kind of like bittersweet. Older people are happier than younger people because younger people are just in the throes of it.
You know? But that's not how it is.
I kind of agree with Jung. Like after 40, there's a different stage of experience. Like life is entirely different. Than when you're 30 and 20 and you're an adventurer, like you should be having as many adventures as possible all your life, but there's a different quality to them at a certain time. You could be like Picasso and keep going, you know, as if you're a teenager when you're, you know, 80. But
don't you know the joke from Norm Macdonald?
What's that?
So he says he can't understand when somebody says, you know, the guy killed himself. I don't understand why, you know? So, and he says, you don't? So you don't know what life is?
Yeah, exactly.
You think you're living in a cotton candy house and that life gets incrementally worse till it ends in a catastrophe?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, why? Oh, it's the other question should be the answer. It's like, why aren't we like jumping out of the, you know, why do we still have this weird kind of like cheerfulness about existence when it's all going to hell, you know?
I mean, Bart would say we're protesting against existence. That's kind of true.
Yeah. 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 But perhaps there's another reason, but that's unspeakable. That's the real. It's not the real, is not only the guy getting his head cut off, right? There's the other side of the real as well, right? We were talking about that last night. We were talking about like, oh, Lacanian real is when like September 11th, or when this sort of like this unspeakable thing happens.
No.
But I think there's unspeakable horror, but there's also unspeakable dot, dot, dot. That's not horror.
Yeah.
But that's, no, that's kind of the position of a, like, I would say like a person of faith in some way or another.
You know,
which is like, not a philosophical position. It doesn't have any philosophy to it, and really, I don't think.
I mean, when I look at like a conversation like that yesterday, I always feel that is like, what's the word from Guattari? Like a mycelium, like a what's the word?
Mycelium is how sort of a certain kind of fungi grow.
Yeah, but there's like a specific kind of mycelium. What's the word? Let me just Guattari. Mycelium.
Is it the idea that it grows simultaneously in different places? It doesn't grow in kind of like 1, 2, 3. It doesn't grow in a progressive way. It's sort of like the forest is not one tree just growing up. It's like the entire tree growing, the entire forest growing simultaneously, or something like that.
Yeah, because like you have mycelium. That's not the word. Maybe it is. I don't know. The rhizome. That's it.
Rhizome,
so you have so you have like a conversation with these people, and it's like you are like in this point where it can go in 100 different directions that are equally interesting because you have so many things going on thematically.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
exactly.
It's like it's not just envy, it's not just scapegoating, it's like what we talked about yesterday. There's so much going on, there's so much deep structure to the whole thing.
Yeah,
it's like you can, and that's, you
it's
know,
not just intellectual either, it's very feeling
exactly.
Involved. Yeah, it's like people's feelings are involved very deeply in those kind of
yesterday things. They were Yeah,
no. Yesterday they were more obvious. They're always
yesterday
are.
Feelings like, were involved.
Yesterday, yes, this is there's some really exciting drama parallax people. You got to check out our intellectual deep web symposium.
Extravaganza.
It was an extravaganza. There were shouting and, you know, crying and people pulling their hair out and you know, blood.
And so we for really, that reason we
Roman
we
Roman Colosseum stuff.
Yeah, you know. So you came up with a fantastic term, the media, the Parallax Entertainment Team, you know?
So. Yes. Yeah.
And so
I was just saying, settle down, guys.
So there was real drama involved yesterday.
Real drama, so. Yeah.
And
I sometimes think like, okay, like this might sound sexist. I'm going to sound sexist a little bit because.
Go ahead.
My wife studies psychology. Women often study psychology and men study philosophy, right? Because philosophy is so intellectual and so like abstract, right? And psychology is always about, you know, your feelings. And so that's the cliche. I mean, that's the cliche, the big cliche. But guys who do philosophy are so emotional about ideas.
Right.
Like they're so pathic about ideas, and I don't know if the women get it all the time, and you know, they don't understand why people like our views of Alexander Bard are so high in men. There's almost no women don't watch that stuff on average. Some do, of course. I'm not making a total generalization, and they think we're just fucking crazy. They think we're just like, what are they doing? Like, why are they getting upset about something called the meta crisis? What the fuck? Like,
right.
I think a lot of women feel that way. And then they're like, they come and they're like, we did this actually. We had a men's group. And then some women from a women's group came and they were like, you guys are, I'm getting a headache just listening to you guys. You guys are so abstract. It's insane. And I'm having this feeling in my heart here, and you know, my body is reacting in this way and this way, and so guys are like outside their body, and then women are just more in their bodies.
Yeah, well, that's not entirely true, because it's not like, entirely okay, if you have like a superficial conversation about some abstract ideas, you can do that to a certain degree without being emotionally attached. But especially if you
the women tune out though. When
yeah, no, but
not.
Especially if you go into the deep structure of some ideas, you know, as we did yesterday. So of course there are emotions attached, because it goes to the core of, you know, what perceive is the human nature, and who we and ourselves who we are, you know. So of course it becomes emotional and full of intensity. You can't have these kinds of conversation without emotions. That's what I mean. It's like,
but why is it all guys? Sorry, why is there like said. One girl here and there?
No,
that's
but
interesting.
No, let me finish. And so we go, because we're talking about the in-between stuff, mm-hmm. you know, in the beginning of the conversation, you know, the things that hold everything together. It's like you have to bring in the error and the messiness in order for the whole system to work. And that's what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you want?
No,
to
no.
Say?
I'm just kind of pointing out like the guys. One of the misunderstandings I think that many women have about guys is they're just like geeks, and they're not really passionate about. They're detached, but they're not. You know.
Right.
That's what I think a lot of women misunderstand men, and you know, and then men sort of misunderstand women in other ways. But we misunderstand each other in that way.
Yeah,
like women, men are often accused of being, you know, intellectual or something like that. But they're which is they're, that's a valid criticism of the masculine neurosis, is to just to live in abstraction outside the body, and you know, see guys who are just doing that all the time. But on the other hand, you know, men really, really like they're really into it. You know, that's and I don't think women kind of get that sometimes, and I think that men kind of don't get how women can kind of see through the whole game of the thing,
yeah,
easily and just instantly, whereas men have to like go through like all of this ridiculous analysis.
I mean, it's just cliches now, but I mean, it's like for men, it's very easy to connect, to have a peer group just centered around an idea, you know?
Yeah.
And for women, it's like, that's not how a woman works. You know, a woman would never, you know, have a circle, a sisterhood circle centered around an idea. It is always something else. It's like an emotional, you know, substructure that they are, you know.
Well, so back to that thing of gossip, it's like the community is what matters to them. It's like, okay, what's going on here, and how's everybody feeling? And, you know, we don't start our conversations like, how are you feeling, Alexander Bard, today? You know, we do a bit at the beginning, but then we get right to the nitty gritty stuff. Whereas I think often women would be like, spend the whole time, you know, doing emotional processing.
Again, it's like, it's a cliche, but
it is, know, a cliche. It is, and it can go the other way. And there's lots of women who are kind of like really, you know, into that kind of thing. But it's a total cliche. I agree. And you feel bad about saying it, because you feel like you're saying that.
No, I've let it go. You know, I'm not feeling bad about saying shitty things anymore. You know,
I do. I still have this, because I'm from Canada, and Canadians are like, they have to be apologetic about everything. Oh, am I hurting your feelings? There's something about the Canadian psyche that they always apologize for everything.
Yeah.
Whereas Americans are like, they don't give a shit, and Germans are just like, okay, it's time to finish right now. It's we have to engineer this properly.
Yes. I have to work on that.
And I'm like, I'm really sorry I hurt your feelings, Tom.
Well, the Canadians are pretty polite.
Canadians are like passive aggressive. Like, look at Trudeau. Like Mr. Package nice guy.
Mm.
Selling arms to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well.
Yeah, well, we didn't, it's too vulgar to even go into all that cultural culture war stuff.
Yeah.
It's too boring.
I have nothing else to add, Andrew.
You have nothing else to add? Okay.
No.
Do I have anything
else? But you can.
Tom, I really like your hair today. It's so nice. Yeah,
I actually have to wash.
Cool thing going. You got this gray and black thing going. That's how a woman would start a conversation, no? Oh, your hair looks really good. A really excellent hair you got.
I don't know. It's really like awesome. I haven't washed it in ages. I'd have to do that.
You've got this like gray wise thing with the black. It's like gray and black. It's like
salt and pepper. It's called in Spain.
Yeah, it's like very James Bond like.
Yeah, exactly, Andrew. Like James Bond.
Congratulations. Yeah, your sex life is not over yet.